Blog Talk Radio.
Woke up this morning with my mind.
Oh, it was
dead on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind. Dead on freedom. So I woke up this morning with my mind.
It was
dead on freedom. Hallelujah.
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 Good morning and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for listening this morning. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And I would love to hear from you. You can email me, SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. Any comments, suggestions, people you want to have on the show, giveaways you're trying to win. You know I give away a lot of stuff, CDs, books, tickets. Restaurant, dinners, all kinds of stuff. So you want to follow on Twitter, you want to become a fan, definitely to learn more about those different giveaways. But this morning, wow, this morning I was telling her earlier, I'm bowing down to her, Judy Richardson. If you don't know her, you need to, if you don't know, you better ask somebody type of thing. She was in SNCC, or SNCC as it's called, from 1963 to 1966. She also has worked on Eyes on the Prize. Many of you know about that. Co-produced Black Side's Malcolm X, Make It Plain. Senior producer with Northern Light Productions. PBS Scar Justice. Can I go on and on and on about all her different, I don't know. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, Joy. It's just a delight to be with you this morning.
Thank you so much for calling in, and again, just much praise to you for the hard work, for allowing me to be where I am right now, really. I mean, that's really how I have to say it. Your work has allowed me to do this show, to go to the schools I've gone to sit in the places, to vote, to support my daughter, you know, who's the next, another generation, just so I'm bowing down. I want to read from your book, because this morning we're talking about your book, Hands on the Freedom Plow, that you helped edit with five other women, black and white women, working together to get these stories out, which talking historically is so important because it's always his story that we're learning about in schools in terms of the black movement and what he has done and he this and he that. So it's important to hear the woman's voice, I believe, about the black movement and SNCC. Let me just read. This is from your journal that you were writing during the time I thought was important, just about day-to-day stuff, but also about some serious issues that happened. June 14th, won't even try to convey the depression, frustration, and just plain cold fear, which pervaded the whole orientation session. June 15th, SNCC office bombed in Macomb, Mississippi. June 20th, three kids, Mickey Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andy Goodman, lost after arrest in Philadelphia, Mississippi. No publicity on it, although we contacted J.D., and FBI, Washington and New Orleans offices on Saturday. June 21st, kids still not found. June 22nd, guys still lost. June 23rd, still lost. June 25th, still not found. President makes another insane statement about inability to send in federal marshals to protect those working in Mississippi. So this is with some serious times going on here, some serious battlegrounds. Let's first start off with, why don't you tell the audience what is SNCC?
Yes, and by the way, let me just mention to folks that that was 1964, the Mississippi Freedom Summer, when we had moved the whole national office also to Mississippi. And that's what most people only know about through Mississippi Burning, which was such a false way of looking at it. So in terms of what SNCC was, it's the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and that's the student group, student-led, student-organized group that grows out of the 1960 sit-ins. So out of that 1960 sit-in, you got sit-ins mushrooming all over the South, primarily coming out of those historically black colleges. So Fisk and Spelman and Morehouse. So, for example, Julian Bond, who becomes chairman of the NAACP, was our communications director, and he comes out of the Atlanta student movement. Ruby Dar Smith Robinson, who becomes an executive secretary of SNCC on Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture's slate, she comes out of Spelman. Diane Nash, who was one of the leaders of the Nashville student movement, along with John Lewis, who is now a congressman. John was our chairman. And they form an organization to help coordinate all of these student sit-ins. And then, because of the amazing leadership in some ways of a mentor of Miss Ella Baker, who herself had this incredible...
I'm glad you mentioned her. I was about to say, I hope she says something about her. Come on now.
you could not talk about SNCC without talking about Miss Baker. You know, Miss Baker, you know, and you're right. You're absolutely right. She is the one who calls. She, at that point, is an executive secretary. I'm sorry, well, temporary executive secretary with Dr. King's organization. She had helped organize Northern support for the Montgomery bus boycott. They bring them on as temporary executive secretary, and it's in that role that she says to then Reverend King, you know, we need to bring these young people together so they can start talking about how they can help one another in these various points of struggle. And so all these folks come up.
That was at Shaw University, correct?
That's correct, in Raleigh, which was her alma mater.
Yes. So now how did you connect? You're from Tarrytown, Factory Town in New York, and now you decide you're going to become a revolutionary. What happened here?
Well, you know, it's funny because and one thing I should say is that this organization that is at first organized around just sit-ins. Then because of what they're bringing in themselves as student leaders and also because of Ms. Baker, becomes this amazing organization that goes into grassroots organizing around the vote, around economic inequity, around all these things that as we're going into the Deep South. And we are dealing with the most underrepresented people. We're talking about the grassroots folks in rural Mississippi, Alabama, Southwest Georgia. And so that organization is also in where I come into contact with it, which is the Eastern Shore of Maryland in Cambridge, Maryland. And I, at that point, you're right, I grew up in Tarrytown, New York, you know, home of the author Washington Irving. So I went to, Sleepy Hollow High School, and our football team was called the Headless Horsemen, you know. But I come in from that. I get a four-year scholarship to Swarthmore College. And it was because they were trying to increase their African-American enrollment because they had so few at that time. And so I come
in. I think you said about 10. I think you said about eight or 10 or something.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, you're right. You are absolutely right. And they had one African-American to my – as a matter of fact, I was just there, and I'm pretty sure my numbers are correct. There was one African-American senior and one who was a sophomore, and then eight of us come in the freshman class, four boys and four girls, because we the black folks, you know, assumed this is so we won't have to date, you know, outside our little group and stuff. We were all housed, you know, with Quaker children, you know, because it was assumed they would be more welcoming, and that was true.
And you talk about that just real quick. You talked about the Quakers. You brought that up. But throughout the book, many different women had involvement with the Quakers because they were supposedly, and I put unquote, tried to embrace African Americans and help them with the struggle. But, you know, in some cases, it didn't work out that way.
That's true. And, yeah, because you assumed that because, excuse me, allergies, you assumed that because they were Quaker that they would understand the necessity of doing the demonstrations that we were helping to work with in the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And that was not necessarily true. As a matter of fact, there were students who said outright, you all shouldn't be doing this. You know, the best thing that you can do for your people is to get your education. There were real arguments on campus about whether white store owners had really the right, which is what even the North was talking about at that time, had the right to deny service to anybody, whether it's on the basis of race or anything else. So when we go, but what was wonderful was that there was a Students for a Democratic Society group on campus, SDS, and that was the group of primarily Northern white progressive students who were supportive of sit-ins, working primarily on northern campuses, and this SDS chapter was called SPAC, the Swarthmore Political Action Committee, and they were helping Gloria Richardson, the strong local movement, local leader in Cambridge, Maryland, to organize around desegregating facilities in Cambridge, Maryland. And so I got on a bus, not the first bus down, you know, with a lot of other college students, not because I have any great commitment to the movement. It's really on a lark. and because my mother's not there to stop me, you know. And so, you know, you should never play down too little just the quirkiness of people, not because they're, you know, any great strengths. But then I get there, you know, and I see Gloria Richardson, and I see this amazing local movement, and I see Pop Herb, who is her uncle, who's leading the movement. There are all these people. And I see Reggie Robinson, who is the SNCC field secretary, who originally was from Baltimore, who comes up to help. So it's like these young people who are changing the world as I know it. And it's like, oh, I want to be part of this, you know.
I tell you, I was part of a movement, too. I happened to be president of the African American Student Union at the University of Arts. I was secretary for all the African American student unions in the Philadelphia area.
Oh, my God.
And so I know when you're at a certain age, this transition that happens, and you become, you know, awakened to your power,
yes,
to your ability as a human, but then as a woman, you know, the power that you have as a woman to lead. And it's just a really amazing experience being a leader. I want to read a little bit from another part of your essay in the book here,
mm-hmm,
and this is called Dropkick.
One of my favorite stories.
Okay. It says, the Atlanta office was involved in demonstrations to integrate Grady Memorial, the municipal hospital. As I was being carried off to the police van on one such protest, I saw John Lewis, then SNCC's chair, being roughly handled as they arrested him, too. I angrily started kicking to get out of the officer's grip so I could help John. In the process, I evidently kicked the policeman who was carrying me in a vulnerable spot. Looking back, it's amazing that other arresting officers didn't retaliate. After I was bailed out of jail, Foreman, who's one of the heads of the SNCC office, summoned me to his office. He showed me a New York Times article mentioning that Judy Richardson from Barrytown, New York, had kicked the policeman in the groin and asked me whether the report was accurate. And, you know, you say you didn't remember. But then he scolds you, reminding that we're supposed to be nonviolent at this kind of and didn't like this kind of negative publicity. Now, that brings up two issues. One, as a woman, you know, being vulnerable, you mentioned about being held in a vulnerable spot. But two, also, this issue of nonviolence but trying to protect yourself. I mean, how to balance that?
Well, you know, it was interesting because, first of all, by the way, when I do teacher training sessions, I show the actual clip, because when I was working on Eyes on the Prize, they actually found the actual clip from the New York Times where they talk about
mm-hmm.
this. But yeah, it was. But it also, I think, it also brings up the whole issue of philosophical as opposed to tactical nonviolence, because oftentimes what folks say is, you know, I mean, it's hard sometimes to represent this with young people because what they have in their mind is, you know, black people and black men not protecting black women, and we're getting beat over the head on the lunch counter. We fall to the ground. We sing, "We shall overcome." They beat us some more. We get up on the stool. We sing some more, and then, you know, it was in doing that you don't get a sense of what nonviolence, both tactical and philosophical, was supposed to do. The bottom line was, for those who were philosophical, and we were, most of the people in SNCC by the time I get there are not philosophical. John Lewis, who is our chairman, he comes out of the national movement. He was philosophical, which meant, like Dr. King and some other people in Dr.
Mm-hmm.
King's organization, they believed that no matter how far, no matter what anybody did to you, you had to remain nonviolent, because if you didn't, the violence would keep escalating, and there was no way to put a cap on it. Now, most of the people I was around, though, were tactically nonviolent, which meant, given that there was nobody at the federal or the state or the local level who was willing to protect you and help you get these federally guaranteed rights, and what you were trying to do was get black people registered to vote without getting them killed, given that you had those, what do you do to at least move in these communities without getting them done over, you know, without getting them totally killed off? And so that is the tactic.
Praetha Hall, am I pronouncing her name correct? Praetha Hall. Yeah, she, you know, you've mentioned her because this brings up the issue of the different types of leadership within SNCC and the woman's voice of leadership. And you mentioned her as being one of the great leaders. But in her essay, she also talks about the conflict she had. She was at a, she calls it, this was a theological crisis for me, because she had gone down and had dealt with the aftermath of Bloody Sunday. But talk to me about what you saw as the difference between how women led in SNCC and men led in SNCC. What were the differences that you saw?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that within SNCC, it was less pronounced, that kind of leadership style was less pronounced than it would have been, say, in the NAACP, which was older, more hidebound, which would have been different than it was in Dr. King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Council, which was very hierarchical because, you know, they were Baptist ministers. And so they were used to that. And Ms. Baker talks about how different it was organized, working within those two, because she had worked in both of them. She was field secretary with the NAACP. In SNCC, because a lot of these women were coming in as leaders in their own right. I mean, when Diane comes in, she's a leader of the Nashville student movement. So you found that, yes, there was some sexism, for example. There were some different leadership styles. But all of the leadership style dealt with consensus, that you could go to a vote, but the first thing was to get consensus. And Diane talks about how if you're asking people to put their lives on the line, then you've got to have people who, even if they don't agree with the decision, at least will allow the decision to move forward. Because, again, their lives are on the line. They've got to somehow buy into this decision. And so sometimes we would talk forever. And this was men and women.
Just to come up with some kind of resolution.
Exactly.
It was for the betterment of the overall good. But let's talk about the issue of sexual harassment. In Bernice Johnson Reagan's, her piece, she talks about getting propositioned with $20 by a white man when she was in school. Do you remember that section of the book there?
Oh, absolutely. That's the Albany, Georgia movement, which is what Bernice comes out of.
She was on the show. She was on the show with Sweet Honey and the Rock. And also, I meant to tell you, before I forget, that when I opened the book and started reading it, the first essay, Simmons, her daughter was on the show talking about, Aisha Shahida Simmons was been on the show talking about the rape documentary. So it's just so many memories just triggered reading the book.
Amazing?
But back to the sexual harassment. Amazing. But back to the sexual harassment issue, sexual harassment from white men on black women, but also within the movement. Unfortunately, there were some incidents. But let's tell the audience, why don't you tell the audience about Bernice's story and the $20, what happened with that?
Yes, I mean, what's amazing with Bernice, she's at Albany State, and she's a leader at Albany State already before she ever gets into SNCC, and she decides that she's tired of these white men calling up the dorm, the women's dorm at Albany State in Georgia, and asking, you know, you want to make $20, just strange white men. And so she decides she's going to call them on it. She's going to catch one of these guys. And so she makes a date, quote, a date, to come out, and she's standing on the corner. Now, she has already told her dean, and she's told another counselor, and she expects them to be there. And she gets there. She tells her boyfriend, too, and her then-boyfriend, and he says, you know, you're crazy and stuff, you know. But she gets out there and suddenly realizes she's there alone by herself. The guy comes by, and she suddenly realizes, I don't know anything about doing this, you know. And so he says, get in the car. And she said, I don't know why I thought to do this, but I said, I want to see your money first. And she says it in as rough a manner as she can. Now, she doesn't know nothing about roughness, right? This is the daughter of a preacher. She really is. But she says, I said it as rough, and he said, well, I have to go get my money. In the meantime, some of the Albany State authorities do come. And the police officer, you know, Chief Pritchett at that time, you know, he comes and they arrest the guy, but they don't really, and nothing happens to him. And she asks about him when the demonstrations finally happen. She asks Chief Pritchett, well, so what happened, though, to that guy? And he said, well, we at least took him in, you know. But that kind of white male harassment of black females you find throughout the book. And by the way, I am impressed. You have read this book. My goodness.
I
it's 700
to read
pages.
As much as possible. I'm going to tell you, I didn't read every single page, but I tried to read as much as possible. I do try to be prepared. I don't want to embarrass myself, so to speak, on live radio. But I want to play a song, and I want to see if this triggers anything for you when I play this, because this is related to you and your story about being in jail. So many of the freedom fighters were in jail in deplorable conditions, no food, no change of clothes, no water, you know, not able to make a phone call, so on and so forth, being beaten in prison. To be honest, you know, I always ask myself, how far am I willing to go for my freedom?
Mm-hmm.
Am I willing to stand up against the billy club? Am I willing to stand up against the shotgun, as many of you did back then? You know, how much courage do I have when the moment comes? And, you know, I hope that I do have the courage. And there have been times where I've had to deal with certain issues. I've been called a nigger myself. I had to deal with, you know, institutional racism. But I'm going to play this song. Let me just see if you remember.
Oh, love. Misery and pain. I know I'll never be the same. Since I fell for you,
oh.
That was Etta Jones singing Since I Fell for You, and I played that because I remember in your story
Yes. That
Annie Pearl. Tell us about Annie Pearl.
Oh, that's lovely. I don't know that version. That's a, I had to change, my goodness. Yes, I'm so impressed. We were in jail. We had just come from a demonstration. We were put in jail, and this time we were put in solitary. And so it was the first time I had been in solitary away from the other demonstrators. And I got really afraid. You know, I suddenly realized, I said, I'm in this thing. It was called the hole because that's all that was there. There was no furniture. There was no toilet. And there was this little hole where you're supposed to do your business. There was no cot. And so I had laid down my coat on the cement floor. They had opened the windows on us. It was December. You know, it's cold. It was all that stuff. But there was a... I crossed from me. It was like maybe 2-3 o'clock in the morning. Everything was very still and silent, and I'm feeling sorry. And then suddenly, in the middle of this, I hear Annie Pearl Avery from Birmingham, Alabama, and she's whistling. Since I Fell for You, you made me leave my happy home, and I don't say anything to her. You know, I just hear this whistling, and I'm thinking, I'm okay. Because Annie Pearl, see, was fierce. Annie Pearl didn't even barely played tactical nonviolence. You know, you had to tell Annie Pearl, you got to get rid of the gun, Annie Pearl, if you're going to go on this demonstration.
Yeah, you said she was carrying a gun around.
Oh, yeah. A gun and 45s. She always had her 45 records and played them over and over again. But she was whistling, Since I Fell for You, you made me leave my happy home. And I thought, you know, I'm okay. I didn't have to say anything to Annie Pearl. I didn't have to say, Annie Pearl, I'm here too. Didn't have to say a word because in my mind I thought, I'm with Annie Pearl. With all those bars, with all the cement, she's with me and I'm going to be okay.
Well, I want to just tell the audience, if you just tuned in, I'm speaking with Judy Richardson, one of the editors of Hands on the Freedom Plow. You can call in 646-929-0368. I'll be giving away copies of this book, so if you're interested in winning, please follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys or become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, you can send me an email. The email is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. Again, this is Judy Richardson, Hands on the Freedom Plow. Just talking about the issue of fear, I want to bring up the issue of family and relationships that have been broken because a lot of the young people, their families, turn their back to them, like, if you're going to go out here and do this crazy stuff, we're not going to support you. The schools were not supporting the young people. Black institutions, you know, historical black colleges, like, look, you're going to lose your scholarships if you go out and participate in this nonsense, and I'm putting quote-unquote nonsense. Just real briefly, talk to me. It's hard to understand, like, we're trying to fight for your freedom. Don't you want freedom? Why are you against me? Why are you not supporting me? Try to explain to the audience the mentality at the time.
Absolutely. And by the way, before I get to it, let me just say I'm so happy that you started your program with Woke Up This Morning With My Mind, because that's how I always start with the teacher training sessions, partly because it helps me wake up. But I love that song. Music, so that's another thing in terms of music and how that helps you overcome fear. But one of the things in terms of the families, with the black institutions, they were worried about their funding. A lot of these folks had to depend upon not just federal funds, like even Howard. Howard was federally sponsored. But I remember Jean Smith, who's one of the editors there, Jean Smith, her last name now, this is so stupid. Anyway, Jean Smith, she was a campus traveler with me, and I was with her in going to Tuskegee and a number of other campus, another black colleges. And I remember we were run out off of Fisk's campus. Now, this is where the movement had started, but we were run off of Fisk's campus by the football team because they didn't want any of that, as you said, quote, this mess on their campus.
Black
campuses, those particularly those that were state-supported, were really locked down in terms of the movement. But what was interesting is that even within that, you had like Wilma Player, who was really important at Bennett College. You had a number of black professors and advisors and teachers who really supported the movement, sometimes overtly, sometimes covertly. And they just somehow managed to support these students. Everybody talks about Wilma Player, for example. But also in terms of family, certainly a lot of families were worried about it, but a lot of the families you get in these women's stories were very supportive of the movement. And certainly in Southwest Georgia, you got women who, you had teachers who were supportive. You had, even though they would get arrested, they would get fired. And that was the other thing. You know, people who supported it got fired. They got their loans called in. If you had land, you couldn't get, you know, your mortgages got called in. You couldn't get the agricultural department allotments. All kinds of things got locked out from when you started to support this movement, besides which, of course, a number of folks had gotten killed.
Judy, real quick, I just want to, since you're talking about the sacrifices that people are making, we only have about 3 minutes, I want to play one more song that I think really hits the nail on the head about the sacrifices people have to make. This is another, I love Sweet Honey and the Rock. They want to know I love their music, so this is another one of theirs.
And when there is a promise of a storm, if you want change in your life, walk into it. And when there is a promise of a storm, if you want change in your life, walk into it. If you get on the other side, you will be different. And if you want change in your life and you are avoiding the trouble, you can forget it. So Harriet would say, wade on in the water. It's going to really be trouble.
I just wanted to play that about, you know, sacrifices that people have to make and deal with, because, again, this just goes about back to the level of courage that these women had, stepping out of traditional female roles, getting on the front line, some behind the scenes, working, writing letters, typing minutes, and so on and so forth. Go ahead.
Absolutely, but the main thing is that there's such a continuing struggle today. I mean, when you see a New York Times headline that says that the top executives of these top 200 corporations their salaries have risen 23% to a general 10.3 million dollars per executive. When you see the Dream Act and it's going under, there are so many economic inequity, immigrant rights. There are just so many things out today that we've got to keep the pressure on, and even put the pressure on the White House, because don't listen just to Wall Street. Don't listen just to the banks. People are losing their mortgages, and unemployment is being cut. Education is being cut. We got to keep the pressure on.
You got to keep the pressure on. And I want to thank you so much, Judy, for coming on the show. You have to come back on. There's so much to talk about. But that was Judy Richardson, Hands on the Freedom Plow. I'll be giving away some copies. Follow me on twitter.com/JoyKeith. Become a fan on Facebook. Check out Hands on the Freedom Plow. Thank you so much, Judy, for being on the show this morning. I really just bow down to you again for being on the show and all the courage that you had throughout the movement.
Thank you. I've so enjoyed this. Thank you.
Thank you. You have a wonderful Saturday.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
thank you, everybody, for listening. Again, I'll be giving away copies of Hands on the Freedom Plow, so please don't forget to follow on Twitter, become a fan on Facebook. Next, I'll be speaking with another artist, a singing artist, Avery Sunshine, so stay tuned. I'll be giving away some of her CDs also, so stay tuned.